Good morning, early birds. You've caught The Worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, rounding up reporting from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. Today we have stories about an oil and gas lease in the Badger 2 Medicine area, the winter bison hunt north of Yellowstone National Park, and simulated medical training in remote areas of Montana. It's Wednesday, January 22nd. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. A natural food retailer is closing its doors in Montana and Wyoming next month. Kay Erickson reports.
The trade publication Progressive Grocery reports that Lucky's Market is planning on closing as many as 32 of its 39 stores in 10 states. Lucky's Market told the employees at the impacted stores at an early morning meeting Tuesday that Lucky's in Billings, Missoula, and Jackson, Wyoming would be closing in February. Lee Newspapers reports that Lucky's opened its Billings store in 2014 and the one in Missoula in 2018. According to the corporate website, Lucky's Market was started in Boulder, Colorado in 2003 by Trish and Bo Sharon. These announced closures come on the heels of the Kroger Company's decision to divest its interest in the retailer following a portfolio review. Kroger was a major backer of the chain. A Lucky's Market spokesperson was unavailable for comment. An employee in the Jackson store said the closing was a business decision, but it came on suddenly. With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Kay Erickson.
A Washington State resident has been diagnosed with a new virus that has infected hundreds and killed six in China. Montana health officials are monitoring the situation, but say they're not, quote, overly worried, unquote. Montana Public Radio's Edward O'Brien reports.
The Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports a Seattle man is the nation's first confirmed case of Wuhan coronavirus. Coronaviruses are a large family of viruses, some of which cause the common cold. Others can evolve into more serious illnesses, including SARS, although the new variant does not appear to be nearly as deadly. Washington state health officials say the Seattle patient is hospitalized, isolated, and in good condition. Montana Health Department epidemiologist Stacy Anderson urges Montanans to keep this development in perspective.
I think we want to put that in context with something like influenza. Right now, we've had more cases of influenza and death in the United States alone than we've had in this outbreak.
The CDC estimates that so far this flu season, nationally, there have been at least 13 million illnesses, 120,000 hospitalizations, and over 6,500 flu-related fatalities. Epidemiologist Stacy Anderson says that as of January 11th, Montana officials have reported over 1,600 flu cases and one flu-related fatality this season. Influenza B is the predominant strain this year. While that's not an exact match for this year's flu shot, Anderson says that's still the best frontline defense against contracting the virus.
Remember that it protects against three or four strains of flu, depending upon which shot you get. Even if, let's say, you've already unfortunately had influenza this year, the flu shot will protect you against the other strains that are circulating.
Anderson also encourages people to wash frequently, clean and sanitize work areas when possible, stay home when you're sick, and please don't cough and sneeze on others. Edward O'Brien, Montana Public Radio.
A lengthy legal fight over an oil and gas lease in the Badger 2 Medicine area near Glacier National Park continued yesterday in federal court. The U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. heard arguments over the U.S. Interior Secretary's authority to cancel the lease. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton has more.
Former U.S. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell in 2016 canceled the last two remaining oil and gas leases in the disputed area near the Rocky Mountain Front. Moncrief Oil and Solenex LLC took the Interior Department to court, arguing that the agency couldn't suddenly change its mind. A U.S. District Court agreed, but Moncrief later dropped its case after reaching a settlement with environmental groups. Solenex is still arguing its case in court. Tim Presso with Earth Justice is representing the Blackfeet Nation and environmental groups intervening in the case.
The challenged lease cancellation decision protects an area that the Blackfeet tribe has described as its last traditional sacred territory. It's an area that
he backed the Interior Department's argument that the government had the right to cancel the oil and gas leases because they violated environmental and federal cultural protections. Presso says Solenex was offered reimbursements for its lease payments and has other ways to seek damages from the federal government.
There's no way to write a check to cover the critical cultural and environmental values of this area. Those have to be preserved.
Solenex attorney David McDonald told justices that the Interior Secretary lacked authority to overturn the lease decades after it was approved.
Because whatever authority agencies may have to reconsider their decisions, that authority must be exercised within a reasonable period of time.
However, justices questioned McDonald about the Interior Department's reluctance to approve drilling on Solenex's lease because it was still determining if that activity would violate federal law. McDonald argued the decision to deny its drilling permit request doesn't void the underlying lease, and future technology may be able to mitigate environmental and cultural harms in the area. It's unclear when the appellate court may hand down its decision. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
Conservation groups announced plans to sue the Trump administration yesterday over a decision that would allow federal officials to kill or remove more than 70 grizzlies over the next decade near Yellowstone. Officials say this is needed because of increasing conflicts with people and property on U.S. Forest Service land. The Center for Biological Diversity and the Sierra Club say a 2019 U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service opinion on cattle grazing in Wyoming's Bridger-Teton National Forest threatens the population of roughly 700 grizzlies that live in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. That opinion allows 72 grizzly mortalities over the next 10 years and recommends conservation measures to be implemented by cattle grazers.
It's really just disappointing to see the federal government caving to the livestock industry once again.
That's Andrea Santer-Sierra, senior attorney at the CBD. She says it's the highest number of bear mortalities she's ever seen the government permit, and that those conservation measures are inadequate and unenforceable. Yellowstone grizzlies are listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, and a government attempt to remove those protections is tied up in federal appeals court. The government has 60 days to respond before the groups formally file suit. Two Democratic Party primary races in Montana are whittling down contenders as the 2020 election season picks up pace. Montana Public Radio's Corin Cates Carney reports.
In the U.S. House race, Matt Raines of Sims ends his Democratic Party bid and turns instead to campaign for a Cascade County state legislative seat. That leaves former state legislator from Bozeman, Kathleen Williams, and current state representative from Missoula, Tom Winter, in the Democrats' primary for the House. The field of Democrats in the governor's primary is also narrowing as former state legislator from Livingston, Riley Neal, drops out. A three-way race still remains there between current Lieutenant Governor Mike Cooney, businesswoman Whitney Williams, and State House Minority Leader Casey Schreiner. On the Republican side, the GOP primary for governor is also a three-way race between current U.S. Congressman Greg Gianforte, State Attorney General Tim Fox, and State Senator Albert Olszewski. Gianforte's departure from the U.S. House is opening a contested primary, with so far six Republicans indicating they'll run for the job. John Ivankovich from Butte was the latest candidate to join that race when he filed for office earlier this month. Candidates have until March 9th to file for office. The primary election is on June 2nd. I'm Corin Cates Carney, Montana Public Radio News.
Montana and Wyoming are asking the U.S. Supreme Court to hear a challenge to Washington State's rejection of a proposed coal export terminal. Kayla DeRoche reports.
On Tuesday, Montana and Wyoming announced they're suing Washington State for its 2017 decision to deny Lighthouse Resources a water quality permit for its proposed Millennium Bulk Terminals project in Longview. According to the lawsuit petition papers, states like Montana see the port as an opportunity to increase coal exports to Asian markets, especially in the face of shrinking domestic prices. Montana Attorney General Tim Fox, who's running for the Republican nomination for governor in 2020, says the block is unconstitutional and politically motivated.
It was based on two things. One is they wanted to favor commerce and commodities from the state of Washington, and they wanted to further their political policy positions concerning blocking the use of coal worldwide.
Washington State Department of Ecology spokesperson Jeff Zink says the state found the project could harm Washington waters and the surrounding areas. Among the possible impacts:
driving 537 pilings into the riverbed, destroying 24 acres of wetlands, eliminating 5 acres of aquatic habitat.
Lighthouse Resources has fought the state's decision in multiple failed attempts since 2017 and continues to do so. If built, the Washington-based terminal would be the only port available in the United States for Montana and Wyoming's coal exports. According to petition documents, the port could ship up to 44 million metric tons of coal annually, mostly from the Powder River Basin. Washington State has 60 days to file a response to Montana and Wyoming's petition. Kayla DeRoche, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
The U.S. Department of Justice recently asked a federal court to dismiss a Gardner woman's claim for $500,000 in compensation from the winter bison hunt north of Yellowstone National Park. Rachel Kramer reports.
In a lawsuit against the U.S. government, Gardner resident Bonnie Lynn alleges bison hunting on an area of Forest Service land adjacent to Yellowstone National Park makes her nearby vacation rental business unviable. The U.S. government's response filed Thursday says Lynn's claims are barred by the 6-year statute of limitation because she bought the property in 2005 when the hunt was already going on. Lynn's attorney, Jared Pettinato, says he doesn't think that argument is going to hold up because the annual bison hunt has been intensifying in recent years.
We think this is a situation that changes every year they issue an operations plan. So we don't think that their argument is going to have much weight.
Bison migrate out of Yellowstone each winter in search of food at lower elevations. Many of them pass through a bottleneck called Beatty Gulch, where hunters wait for their arrival. Pennato says it seems like a war zone.
You can hear the gunshots, and then all the hunters just like mob this little county road that's very narrow and park all their trucks and their trailers and everything, and it's hard to get in and out. Some people can't even pass through the area with their trucks.
Bonnie Lynn claims the noise, disruption, and danger associated with the hunt have prevented her from being able to rent her 2 cabins during the winter, lowered her property values, and caused her emotional trauma. Pettinato says his firm will file a response by February 13th and request oral argument. An attorney for the United States Department of Justice could not be reached by the deadline for this story. A federal judge in Montana denied a separate lawsuit seeking to temporarily stop the hunt in December. With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Rachel Kramer.
Today, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear oral arguments both for and against the Montana Supreme Court's decision to shut down a school choice program it said violated the state constitution's ban on public money flowing to religious schools. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports the case may decide whether Montana and other states can exclude religious schools from school choice programs.
Kendra Espinoza's 2 daughters attend Stillwater Christian School in Kalispell. They're in 6th and 8th grade, and Espinoza says she sent them there 5 years ago for its strong academics and faith-based teachings.
And so I really wanted a better input for them, for their lives. And so I wanted them to have something that was more grounded to the same values that we have at home.
Tuition for Espinoza's 2 daughters could total over $15,000 per year, but she gets up to 50% tuition assistance from the school itself. Espinoza says she was also receiving up to $1,000 from a school choice program set up by the Montana legislature in 2015, which she says was a huge help as a single mother.
I had at one point 2 extra jobs besides my regular full-time job. Now I'm just doing my regular main job, and then I have another office-type job that I do from home.
The program incentivized state residents to donate to participating nonprofit scholarship organizations by giving them a $150 tax credit. But shortly after the first nonprofit, Big Sky Scholarships, signed on, the Montana Department of Revenue crafted a rule excluding religious schools. The department says this was needed to make the tax credit program compliant with the state constitution's no-aid provision. That provision bans public dollars from directly or indirectly flowing to religious schools. Espinoza and 2 other families with children attending Stillwater Christian first took the case to a district court in Flathead County at the behest of Virginia-based law firm Institute for Justice.
Institute for Justice met with me and asked if I would join them in this case, and I said yes, I would, but of course I had no idea that it was going to end up at such a big level.
Espinoza won in trial court, but in 2018, the Montana Supreme Court ruled that allowing religious schools to participate in the program would constitute an indirect payment from the state and therefore violated the state constitution. It also found that the revenue department didn't have the authority to craft a rule excluding religious schools and struck down the entire program. Michael Bindis, a senior attorney with Institute for Justice, argues that decision violated the federal constitution's establishment clause, which says government should be neutral to religion.
The Supreme Court in 2002 held that the U.S. Constitution allows religious options alongside non-religious options in voucher programs as well as in tax credit programs like the one Montana has.
To support its argument, the Institute for Justice also points to Trinity versus Lutheran, a Supreme Court ruling 2 years ago that found the state of Missouri couldn't exclude churches from a grant program for resurfacing playgrounds. Bindis wants that precedent to expand to school choice programs.
There are a number of other states that have constitutional provisions similar to Montana's that have interpreted them in a way similar to the Montana Supreme Court as requiring the exclusion of religious options from these types of programs. If we win, those states will no longer be able to discriminate on religious grounds.
Chief legal counsel to Governor Steve Bullock, Rafe Graybill, says Montana and other states with no aid provisions have the right to decide whether public dollars can support religious institutions. Graybill says when citizen delegates made that choice while rewriting the state constitution in 1972, they did so to protect public schools.
They saw public education as the most important thing that the state could provide. And so they provided all these protections for the public system to ensure its quality and to prevent its dilution in our Constitution.
Graybill, who is running as a Democrat for state attorney general, says Montana's Constitution is certainly at risk of being changed in this case. But he doesn't want to predict whether the court's decision will have an impact beyond the state's borders. Public education advocates like National Education Association President Lily Eskelson Garcia are worried that a decision could force states with voucher and tax credit programs to fund religious schools.
And it is all about undermining public education for the purpose of expanding state voucher programs. And it is absolutely a drain on critical resources from our neighborhood public schools.
The ultimate impact of the case won't be known until the court hands down its ruling, which is due by June. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
Healthcare providers, like athletes, need routine and rigorous training to stay on top of their game. But getting that instruction is challenging for those practicing frontier medicine. One Montana program is now delivering state-of-the-art simulated training to some of the state's most remote clinics and hospitals. And experts say it's helping save lives. Montana Public Radio's Edward O'Brien has more.
He's cyanotic.
Okay, guys, let's get some oxygen on him.
A team of Community Hospital of Anaconda obstetrics nurses who normally specialize in pregnancy and newborns is working a particularly challenging simulated case.
Timmy, can you speak to me?
A 5-year-old who was found unresponsive on a local school playground. He has no obvious injuries, but he's unconscious and his
blood sugar is low. Okay,
can we
get the IV in?
Timmy's pupils aren't responding and his breathing is irregular. An attending pediatrician arrives, assesses the situation, and makes a recommendation.
Let's try pushing a little bit of Narcan.
Narcan, or naloxone, is used to treat narcotic overdoses. The nursing team quickly prepares 2 milligrams of the opioid blocker.
2 milligrams of Narcan in.
At 10:27.
He's coughing.
Oh, he's vomiting all over. Oh my God.
Okay. Oh, suction. Okay. Rapid suction.
Suction him out.
Timmy, good job. It's okay.
It's okay, buddy.
Within seconds, Timmy is regaining consciousness.
Are you feeling okay? You had a little accident. Your teacher brought you in.
I don't remember. My tummy hurts.
Your tummy hurts? Okay. Can you tell me your whole name?
Timmy doesn't respond because Timmy is a mannequin. The nurses aren't even inside Community Hospital of Anaconda. They're in a 45-foot-long custom-built truck in the hospital's parking lot. It's a high-tech mobile training laboratory operated by a nonprofit called Simulation in Motion Montana, or SIM Montana. Project Director Ben King.
We have effectively trained our medical providers the same way we train 14-year-old lifeguards for the last couple of decades. We're finally breaking out of that.
SIM Montana operates three of these rolling training labs, one each in Montana's western, central, and highline regions. Together, they annually rack up over 100,000 miles to provide ongoing medical education to the state's rural healthcare providers. Bozeman-based Best Practice Medicine has operated the training program along with a volunteer board of directors since 2017. Ben King, the company's CEO, says the program is the first of its kind in the nation to receive accreditation from the Society for Simulation Healthcare.
It's a huge honor for us to be awarded that. And again, it makes us first in the nation. So Montana can be proud that right here in our own state, we're leading the way in mobile simulation.
SIM Montana instructors use computerized medical mannequins programmed to simulate various emergencies. They build that illusion in a variety of ways. For instance, they appear to breathe and have heartbeats and pulse points. When connected to special monitors, they display a heart rate, oxygen levels, blood pressure, and other vital signs. They have lots more tricks up their silicon sleeves, including subdural lights to simulate changes in skin color and tone. They react to medications. Their eyes blink and move, and the pupils react realistically to light. The mannequins can live or they can die during training sessions. Timmy's face can make almost 20 expressions, ranging from shock and anger to inquisitiveness.
And sometimes if I come in to talk to him, he looks at me, which is really fun.
This is creepy.
Joe Poole is a simulation team leader and co-founder of the for-profit Best Practice Medicine, which helps manage the training program. At the beginning of every training session, Poole and his colleagues reassure participants they're in a safe zone. No harsh judgments will be doled out, no professional penalties recorded. Following the session, they debrief to discuss what worked well and, perhaps more importantly, what did not.
What could be the likely causes of an unresponsive child?
Diabetes,
injury, head trauma,
Drugs did not cross my mind at all.
Not one.
SIM Montana's Ben King appreciates that honesty and understands the nurse's perspective.
We didn't have resources like this up until 2 years ago in Montana, and we just didn't do this kind of training. These folks here that we've been working with today, if they had an accidental pediatric overdose that come in, they may have missed it. They are good providers and they care about what they're doing. It's not a value statement about the clinicians and their knowledge base. It's a logistics question of what kind of training do they have access to.
Small rural hospitals in Montana can't afford to get this kind of intense training because of a multi-million dollar startup donation from the Leona M. and Harry B. Helmsley Charitable Trust. The Helmsley Trust announced last week it's awarding the program another $2 million to ensure it can continue offering its services in Montana. The project also relies on a three-pronged funding approach, including fees, initiative-based funding, and philanthropic donations to cover the ongoing costs of travel, training, and equipment.
The training opportunities for us are few and far between.
Brenda Green is chief nursing officer of Ruby Valley Medical Center in the small southwest Montana community of Sheridan. It's one of the state's 48 critical access hospitals serving rural Montana.
If we don't bring it in, we have to send our staff away. Financially, it's extremely expensive, and then there's time lost when the staff have to leave.
The five-bed Ruby Valley Medical Center has received several SIM Montana best practice training sessions over the past couple of years. Green says it's an impressive teaching tool.
Anytime you can use something that's more lifelike, instead of just going through a scenario and talking through it, pretending to do your actions is going to
be a much better training.
Sim Montana Best Practices, Ben King.
And the science is pretty robust. If I can increase your physiologic heart rate by about 20%, I will increase your long-term memory retention by over 60%. That's why the military trains under some psychological stress, because we want your heart rate to go up. If your heart rate goes up, you're going to be able to perform better under that stressful circumstance.
The Ruby Valley Medical Team asked Sim Montana to provide a training session last spring on sepsis infections. These are aggressive infections that can rapidly overwhelm the body. Unless quickly diagnosed and treated, sepsis can lead to sudden death. Small rural hospitals don't necessarily see many sepsis cases, but the threat always looms. In healthcare jargon, they're called high-consequence, low-frequency cases. Ruby Valley Chief Nursing Officer Brenda Green says Sim Montana's approach was fresh, engaging, and particularly effective.
We've had sepsis training before, but we never did get to train with simulation of a patient crashing kind of right before your eyes, and it's like, okay, what are you going to do next? What are your options? It makes it more real. And everybody was up on the protocol. Everybody was gung-ho, ready to go if that came through our ER.
And shortly after that mandatory all-hands training session, Green says a sepsis case came through that door. The hospital's clinicians quickly recognized the symptoms and immediately initiated treatment. Green says that patient is alive today thanks to that fast response. Ben King says he hears these stories all the time. The Sim Montana program isn't limited to overdose cases. It also offers childbirth simulators, various trauma training sessions, and EMS refresher courses, among other programs. King, a career flight medic, says he quit that job in part because he wasn't satisfied with the quality of medical training in the healthcare industry, especially for those practicing in rural areas.
I've seen patients that didn't survive because we didn't do the right thing. Patients have not survived because I didn't do the right thing. And that sucks. And that's something you take home with you. But being able to listen to the stories of people who say, we trained with you and I did better because of that, that is the achievement of my lifetime.
According to Sim Montana, it so far provided 300 simulation training sessions, educating some 5,400 Montana healthcare professionals. Edward O'Brien, Montana Public Radio.
Can you overhead page the PED, please?
X-ray and lab on the way.
Okay.
Very wheezy.
Okay, so let's get...
Can we get RT here too?
Yep.
And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for you early birds tomorrow morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Meadowlark Call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.